Good morning. Well, to use that dreaded and frankly infuriating phrase, we are where we are, and that is at level 5. And yes, for a whole multitude of reasons, it's incredibly difficult. But it was this opening call into Liveline on Thursday that perhaps put things into perspective. This is Patricia McGowan, Director of Nursing at Nightingale Nursing Home in Galway.
At the moment, we have 24 residents in house. One gentleman died yesterday.
Yeah.
We have 2 transferred to hospital today, and that's left us with the remainder. And
of those 24, how many have tested positive for COVID, Patricia?
We have 2 negative residents, that's all.
So 22 out of 24.
Yep.
Left. And how many staff are there at the moment?
We're currently down to the bare bones, Joe, to be honest with you. We have a nurse and a carer on duty at the moment. They're working 13-hour shifts.
Oh my God.
The remainder of the staff have tested positive. I don't know, to be honest with you, I don't know how the girls down there are coping. They have to be just running on adrenaline at this stage because they have nothing else. They haven't even time to go outside and take a breath of air.
So at the minute in the nursing home, there's one nurse and one carer. And where are they on their shift? Are they near the end of their shift?
They won't be finished till 9 o'clock tonight, Joe.
And what time did they start at, Patricia?
8 o'clock this morning.
And what was during the night, how many staff were on?
We got help from the HSE for the night.
Okay.
They did send us a nurse during the night, but they promised us carers for this morning and they never materialised. And you know, we didn't even get a phone call to say that they weren't coming. That, you know, we were. I'm devastated. I can't put it into words how helpless we all feel. And we felt that we were going to get help, and it just hasn't transpired. And, you know, our residents are down there, and we're trying to keep them alive. I'm sorry, I don't usually cry.
No, you're
but
okay.
We're trying to keep them alive and well, and we really feel abandoned. That's the truth.
Yeah.
And while Patricia praised HICWA for advocating for extra staffing, at that time it had not been forthcoming.
And Patricia, what was the situation, the staff situation yesterday during the day? One care, one nurse, one care.
That same nurse worked a 13-hour shift. That same carer worked a 13-hour shift. The girl that worked the previous night, the carer that worked the previous night, she stayed on for a couple of hours in the morning, but she was back on again last night. So, you know, these girls can't do this indefinitely. They can't. They'll get sick themselves. And then where are we? We have literally nobody then. And we have those residents down there looking to us to care for them and to keep them safe and well. And we're not in a position to do that.
And she told Joe her fears for the future.
It's the worry of it. It's the worry of where this virus will go next. What will it do to those residents next? I just can't even get the words out. I feel so frustrated and so helpless and so alone in it, really. We're alone. We're like a little island down there in the middle of rural Ireland, and nobody cares that we're looking after somebody's mum and dad and granddad and granny. I mean, that could be my mum. Or my dad. And, you know, would I like to be told, I mean, the feedback we get from the people that are supposed to give us assistance is don't panic, leave it with me. Well, I'm sorry now, but we're looking after all these older people who are ill. And yes, we're panicking. No, we can't leave it with you.
Yeah.
If it was your mother in the bed, would you be happy with that answer from the nurse? You wouldn't. Who would? And yet we're supposed to be able to just accept that as the way it is. You know, I thought, you know, our residents, yes, they're in a private nursing home. They're not in the public system, but they are citizens of this country.
Yeah.
And this country has an obligation to look after them. They've contributed to this country for decades, and now nobody cares. What kind of civilized society is that?
Patricia McGowan, director of the nursing home in East Galway, where the majority of residents and Patricia herself had tested positive for COVID-19. And thankfully, the HSE did put adequate staffing in place for all of those residents. Later on Drive Time, John Cook spoke to Ballygar GP Dr. Martin Daly. It was his tweet that had highlighted this situation, and he'd subsequently spoken to Claire Byrne.
Dr. Daly, it would seem it took a doctor, as you said, at the depths of despair, sending out this tweet, and it took a nursing home nursing manager, COVID positive herself, crying on the radio on RTE to get the attention needed for these vulnerable residents in this nursing home. Could there be other cases like this? Will there be other nursing homes in this situation?
There will be. The prevalence of this COVID coronavirus in the community is now high. We're seeing increased cases amongst young people. And of course, once it's in the community, it will get into nursing homes. And we really need to be nimble and flexible and have rapid response to evolving situations, because it's going to arise in other nursing homes.
And later, Sarah spoke to Pádraic McDonagh, whose mother lived in the Nightingale nursing home and who has contracted COVID-19. And they were joined on the line by Mary Butler, Minister of State for Mental Health and Older People. And she fully acknowledged that staffing was a major issue. But Pádraic was angry.
I accept that resources are stretched, but hang on a second. This has been on the case for 7 months. Billions have been spent investing here. Is it beyond the capability of the HSE to do some strategic planning, some contingency planning, taking into account agency resources? Where was the resource management here? Where was the forward planning? Where was the creative thinking to anticipate situations that might arise? It's like they only discovered this week that they don't have agency staff. Give me a break. These people are paid a lot of money. They can't complain that they didn't have money to spend. Billions have been put into this. Well, what were they doing for the last 6-7 months?
All right. If I could just say, Pádraic, in reply to that, it's up to each nursing home to have a contingency plan put in place. So the majority of nursing homes would have a contingency plan. They would have a huge amount of work done in relation to infection prevention control.
I accept that. My question to you would be, how come the contingency of a massive catastrophic virus striking any nursing home, to what extent has the HSE prepared for, anticipated and got ready to resource that?
The HSE have done a huge amount of work, but if I could just reiterate what I said, the HSE are currently on site in 162 different services,
and it's very, very difficult to get staff
in specific areas overnight.
But how, Sarah wondered, might we prevent something like this happening again?
You have identified staffing as being the major challenge here, and if we're already at the point where one nursing home can't get agency staff, can you tell me what is in plan at the moment to make sure that this can't happen again, that there will be staff available in future?
Well, what we'll all have to do is we will have to work together. And I was delighted to hear Pádraic said that when he spoke to the nursing home, they had so many different nurses and volunteers that said they would come and try and help. Now, currently, the Sale to Hospital Group and the HSE Community Service are working with the COVID-19 response team to try and make sure that sufficient and adequate staff will be in place.
Okay.
This is going to be a challenge, Sarah. I won't say I'm not going to try and dress it up. It is going to be a challenge, because when you have specific areas where there might be quite rural communities and you don't have an extensive amount of agency staff available in that particular area, that's something that we're going to have to look at very closely and try and ensure that this does not happen again.
Minister of State for Mental Health and Older People Mary Butler, as heard on Drive Time. And just how easy and fast this virus can spread was illustrated yet again by another example, here brought to us by Cathy Halloran on Monday's Morning Ireland. One man, just the one, infected at least 56 people. Here's how.
This index case, as he is referred to, was abroad on his holidays, but he did not restrict his movements as per the current HSE guidelines when he got home. Now, he had mild symptoms, including a runny nose and a mild sore throat. He checked his temperature. It was normal. He felt reassured by this and socialised with a group of friends. He later, however, tested positive for COVID-19. However, by this stage, he'd already infected a number of his friends. Three of these friends then went on to infect their families. Now, another friend of the group who he infected felt unwell and contacted her GP to arrange a COVID-19 test. Now, she had the test in the morning, but by the afternoon she felt a bit better and decided to go to a friend's party. After the party, she got her test result and it was positive. But by attending the party while waiting for her test result, she ended up infecting a number of other people, the report says. But also, the index case had a close extended family who visited each other's houses regularly. They were quite close. This led to some extended family members also getting infected with COVID-19. One of his extended family members, who had no symptoms whatsoever, what we describe as asymptomatic, he played a match with his local team and a number of his teammates were infected as a result. The team members then went on to affect a number of other people.
Ooh, easily done, I suspect, but quite the cautionary tale. And as to whether this will all be over by Christmas, well, Philip Nolan, chair of NPHET's Epidemiological Modelling Advisory Group, joined Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland. And sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but you might just want to stick your fingers in your ears for this next bit. La 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 la, because it's not what any of us want to hear.
We need to prepare now as a population that at the end of this period of restrictions, we behave differently. We think very carefully that what we need to keep under control through Christmas and into the new year is the number of unique social contacts we have per week.
You don't feel, Professor Nolan, that a yo-yo of restrictions is inevitable, is that right?
I think it's
entirely
possible.
That seems to be what the Taoiseach was suggesting yesterday.
Well, I don't think anybody's... The use of word yo-yo kind of suggests something that's violently unstable and going back and forth every couple of weeks.
Well, even if it was every couple of months, as it has been the last time, you have restrictions, then you ease them, then you increase them. Is that sustainable?
It's entirely possible that that's... the Taoiseach's absolutely right. And it's important to be honest with people. If following December and January we find levels of cases rising and in particular rising quickly, we may need to intervene again. If we intervene early, that intervention can be shorter. But the amount of time that we buy ourselves and how long out that might happen really depends upon our individual behaviours and how strong our public health departments are.
Happy New Year to us. And the following day, Health Minister Stephen Donnelly came into Morning Ireland and he said that this lockdown was a preemptive strike. And then he was asked this.
What happens if we get to the 2nd of December and the cases are still running at more than 100 a day? What do we do?
Well, look, that's a hypothetical, Anya. We have an exit strategy, which is we're going to go for 6 weeks.
Well, it's a possibility, Minister, and people want to know, what would you do?
Well, it depends. It depends what the situation is. So government will look at it carefully, NPHET will look at it carefully, and they look at a range of factors. So they look at the level of cases, they look at the rate of growth of cases, they look at the positivity rates, they look at the R number, and also they look at it county by county and region by region. So one of the things we've stated is that the exit from this doesn't have to be, for example, the whole country at one time. It could be region by region. So really, it depends on a lot of factors. What we want to see is we want to see the curve flattened again. And what we all want to see is a move back to level 3 on the 1st of December.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Arena, Neil Hannon of the Divine Comedy spoke to Kay Sheehy about his musical influences.
I hadn't really a clue what I wanted, but I knew what I liked. And I just discovered Scott Walker, the sort of 60s baritone orchestral pop legend. And also Michael Nyman was a big figure for me, a sort of a combination of the two, but also with late 80s indie and late 70s, early 80s UK pop music of the sort of Elvis Costello variety mixed in. And it sort of all splurged out in that first album.
So clearly Neil knew about Scott, but did Scott know about Neil?
You sent, and you talked about that Book Lovers track. He was quite taken by that track, wasn't he?
Funnily enough, I've heard this, but I don't know where this rumour has come from, because I don't think Scott was taken by anything I did, really.
Did he? Did you communicate with him, and did he get back to you, or was it one way?
I kept sending him my records just because I loved him, you know, and I sent Michael Nyman my records as well. I don't know what I thought was going to happen with them, but then Scott did an interview for the first time in like 8 years with the French magazine Les Incorruptibles in sort of 95. And he said, oh, yeah, that little Irish guy, he keeps sending me his records. I think he likes my earlier work more than my current stuff. And to me, that's all I needed. I framed it, put it on my wall.
Perhaps a love best described as unrequited. But what about the new super-duper box set?
I'd always wanted a box set, I have to say. There's a CD at the beginning called Juvenilia, of all my earliest stuff. And it contains sort of recordings of demos that I made when I was 13, 14, 15. And I'd kept on this sort of best of cassette that I'd made at the time, because I knew even at the age of 15 that, oh, they'll need this for the extra CD in the 30th anniversary box set. That's how sure of myself I was.
Neil Hannon of The Divine Comedy, as heard on Arena. Bobo Supreme is a character created by actor and writer Tim Robbins for a new podcast. And Tim spoke to Miriam on Sunday about the evolution of the character. And might he have been channeling the Donald?
I mean, were you directly inspired by the character of Trump, or were there other inspirations for Bobo Supreme?
I wrote it from the point of view of this character called Ubu Wa, the Ubu the King, a French surrealist character from the early part of the 20th century that kind of shattered the standards of theater at the time. At the first performance of it in Paris, the audience rioted and tore up the seats of the theater and threw them onto the stage. They were so outraged by this character called Ubu the King. I had played him when I was in my 20s, and as I was sitting down to write this a year and a half ago, he was the character that was most prevalent in my mind. How do I get to the inner psyche of this very powerful man who is president of the United States? What are the dreams that this man has? Who is the inner voice? What is he like behind closed doors? What does he actually say when the cameras are off? Those are all fascinating things for me as a writer, and particularly for satire. Satire really has to be rude. It has to dare to offend. And the satirist has to look at the material he's doing and not be afraid of being dangerous with it.
And he was always going to take a satirical approach.
Humor is absolutely essential in this time. It's one thing to imitate somebody or to make fun of somebody, which happens a lot nightly shows and certain entertainments. That wasn't my interest here. I didn't want to do an imitation. I didn't want to be offensive to his family members. I didn't want to get in the mud on that. I did want to get into what it is to be so powerful and to be unwilling or incapable of admitting one is wrong. I think that's something that is at the core of the character of Bobo Supreme. What is that? You know, what, you know, is that a 2-year-old? A child before they have reached the age of reason? It wants everything now. If he doesn't get his way, throws a tantrum, excludes people that say no to him or criticize him. And for me, humor is the way in. Humor is the way that we can get through this. It's always been the way to tell truth to power, from the first fool that did it in front of a king to the great humorists and playwrights that have illuminated a truth to the powerful at the time. It's a daring profession. It's why art is feared. It's why the artist is the one that is censored or excluded or sometimes killed in regimes that are not interested in free speech. Authoritarian regimes always round up the artists and the intellectuals and the writers first before they worry about anyone else. And why is that? It's because artists tell truth to power.
Writer and actor Tim Robbins with Miriam. But what effect has 4 years of Donald Trump had on book sales? Well, quite a healthy one, it seems. Silver linings. Here's self-confessed White House tome addict Stephanie Preisner, as heard on The Book Show.
Some people in hair salons read about Kate Middleton and Meghan Markle, and I'm sitting there licking the pages, obviously pre-pandemic, but just devouring them. It's just fascinating stuff. And I think if you read enough of them, you get a better sense. It's like a Venn diagram. You know, one book gives you one circle of what Donald Trump is like. Another book gives you another circle, and where they overlap. And the more you read, you get a kind of a holistic view of what a despot this guy is.
Before I ask you about those, weirdly, let's flip this on its head. One of the things that's happened is that Trump has been really good in the United States for book sales.
Yeah, because he's a caricature. I mean, if I were to write a character of Donald Trump in one of my TV shows, my producers would come back and be like, can you just tone it down a small bit? Like, you cannot write this. And so for people who write books, this is really happening in real life, and people are coming out and they're telling their stories. And because he has his thumb so heavily on the people and he demands such loyalty, when he breaks people and people finally get free, it's like Belle running away from the beast, being like, let me tell you what it was like in the castle. And I just cannot get enough of it.
And one book Stephanie had read about the Donald was Rage, written by Bob Woodward.
He gets such great access because he feeds into Donald Trump's ego. Because he has historically had great access and written such great books, Donald Trump is like, oh, if this guy interviews me and I give him insight, I'm going to be up there with the other people he's interviewed. And so Bob Woodward, he's the guy who broke the stuff that, like, Donald Trump knew how bad COVID-19 was before this all happened and he was playing it down. I don't know if it's stupidity or egotism on Trump's part, but Bob Woodward has access no one has seems to have had.
And lo and behold, in the great Venn diagram of radio, Bob Woodward himself was Ryan Tuberty's guest on Thursday. And Ryan was to be found sleeping overnight in the studio. Such was the level of excitement on Team Tubbs. But Woodward himself was in a sombre mood.
You said recently that Trump is assassinating the presidency.
Yeah, well, Trump is assassinating the presidency because, as we are, what, less than 2 weeks before the election here, Trump has made continuous statements that he will not accept a peaceful transfer of power. He has said we can't count on the electoral system, of course, which is the basis in any democracy for constitutional legitimacy for the President of the United States. He is assassinating the office and its responsibilities to make sure that democracy continues. And so now we're going to have an election. And when do we get the results? When are people going to accept the results? There's lots of mail-in voting. He's criticized that. I mean, already, I think 30 million people in this country have voted. The president should be the person organizing and making sure that it's a fair system. But for him to attack it so directly, I call it, yes, an assassination, because that's what it is.
Journalist Bob Woodward speaking to Ryan. And on Thursday, the final presidential debate was held between Biden and Trump. And with the help of a mute button and a firm moderator, we actually heard some points on policy. And the main topic for discussion? You guessed it, COVID-19.
He says that we're learning to live with it. People are learning to die with it. You folks home will have an empty chair at the kitchen table this morning. That man or wife going to bed tonight and reaching over to try to touch their, out of habit, where their wife or husband was, is gone. Learning to live with it. Come on. We're dying with it. Because he has never said, you said it's dangerous. When's the last time? Is it really dangerous still? Are we dangerous? You tell the people it's dangerous now? What should they do about the danger? And you say, I take no responsibility.
Let me talk about your two.
Excuse me. I take full responsibility. It's not my fault that it came here. It's China's fault. And you know what? It's not Joe's fault that it came here either. It's China's fault. They kept it from going into the rest of China for the most part but they didn't keep it from coming out to the world, including Europe and ourselves.
Vice President Biden.
The fact is that when we knew it was coming, when it hit, what happened? What did the president say? He said, don't worry, it's going to go away. Be gone by Easter. Don't worry, the warm weather. Don't worry, maybe inject bleach. He said he was kidding when he said that, but a lot of people thought it was serious. A whole range of things the president has said. Even today, he thinks we are in control. We're about to lose 200,000 more people.
And yesterday, Claire Byrne spoke to former CNN correspondent Gina London. And Claire remarked on how this debate was almost verging on the civilised. Almost.
We all heard, Gina, that President Donald Trump's advisors told him to pull back a little bit, to use a softer touch this time round. And just listening to that clip, you can probably say that he took that advice. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's without a doubt that President Trump put forth his best measured presidential presence performance yet. It really was a good performance. But with the president lagging and all the polls, Claire, he really needed Biden in this debate to make a big stumble or make a mistake, which he did not. And so even though this was much more measured from President Trump, there still is a narrow pathway for him to try to navigate to get to hold and retain the White House coming up in just a few more days.
Gina London with Claire yesterday. It is all to play for. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now, with all of this sitting in, and there's a lot of it, home and what that means takes on a particular resonance. On Sunday Miscellany, sailing for home was on the mind of Donal Hayes in his piece, 0 Degrees.
My compass points due north and has been like that all morning since I got my bearing from the light on the Old Head. Every lighthouse has a unique pattern and the Old Head flashes twice every 10 seconds. If you find a second light, you can calculate where you are. I need to head dead north now, a bearing of 0 degrees, going nowhere, going home.
And as Donal approached safe harbour, just what home meant to him became ever clearer.
Tonight, there will be a hot shower, clean clothes and sheets. There will be food cooked by somebody else and beer from a tap. There will be family to love and friends to make me laugh. There may even be singing. There will definitely be singing. I am home now, but here are still patterns that tell us all where we are. Not from a lighthouse, but from the tone of voice, the raising of an eyebrow. There are cardinal marks to let us know how far we have come. There are obstacles and shallows and low tides to be navigated. There are storms to be weathered and doldrums to be sat out, and all to be done without a damp, pencil-marked chart. There is, however, a strange comfort in going to sleep with the certain knowledge that your bed will not be in collision with an oil tanker. A comfort in not getting up on the hour to look at the horizon. A comfort in being home.
Donal Hayes as heard on Sunday Miscellany. And a place to call home is on the mind of campaigner Father Peter McFerry, who spoke to Ray Darcy on Monday. And while it may only be a very small chink of light in what has been quite the dark, we'll take anything we can get.
On the positive side, there has been more long-term accommodation has become available. A lot of Airbnbs have come back into being residential rented property, and that has made available long-term accommodation to people that would not otherwise have been made available. And we've helped in the last six months, we've helped about 700-800 people out of homelessness into their own accommodation. And that's partly through the Airbnbs. Mm. As well as that, probably less people were looking for private rented accommodation. They weren't going to go out viewing. And so maybe it was a combination of both that enabled homeless people to find accommodation.
The other positive
was the ban on evictions. The ban on evictions saw a dramatic drop in the number of people who are homeless. The number of people who are homeless between March and July dropped by 500. Number of children dropped by 700. And yeah. The number of families dropped by 350. So between more long-term accommodation and less people becoming homeless, the problem of homelessness has reduced a little bit.
Ooh, a little bit, but better than nothing. And the rent eviction ban has been extended to January 2021. And housing and mortgages were under the microscope when Brian Hayes, Chief Executive of the Banking and Payments Federation Ireland, was grilled, for there is no other word for it, by Sarah McInerney on Tuesday's Drive Time. Because now, pandemic or not, if you want an extension or payment break on your mortgage, it's going to be recorded on the Central Credit Register, which will in turn affect your future credit rating.
It's not some kind of black mark on someone, it's simply a practical piece of information. And I would make the point to people, you know, lenders in the future, if they see and they look back on someone's credit history, they'll know that this year and possibly next year or whenever this pandemic is with us, that that's part and parcel of the register. It's not some kind of score, it's not a black mark.
But it is, Brian, it is a score and a black mark, because it means your credit rating is damaged. That is a black mark in terms of borrowing in the future.
So I think, well, firstly, it's primary law, and the banks are simply the reason it didn't,
I understand that they're following the law because they've decided that they're going to do this on a case by case basis. But the whole point is, this wasn't in place. You weren't going to have your credit rating damaged under the last system that the banks had in place, which was the blanket payment break. Because so the banks have chosen to rescind the blanket payment break, now if you do look for a payment break, your credit rating is damaged. And I'm wondering why the banks feel that they should do that to borrowers at this time.
So there was no guarantee from any regulator or the European system that even were we to continue with a blanket payment break, that we wouldn't have to affect the credit history of people. And that is not the position. So the law is the law. We're simply implementing the law. If legislators want to change the law, that's a matter for them.
The law is the law, eh? And rules be rules. Well, speaking of that, remember Golfgate back in August? Just guess who was swinging a five iron?
It shouldn't have happened, and I think it caused a huge amount of angst in the country, and I fully recognise that.
Did you know you were breaking the rules?
I didn't really, and I when I went into the situation, I wished I hadn't. I know at the time there are two very large rooms. An attempt was made by all of the organisers and the hotel concerned, but that, irrespective of the rules, I shouldn't have been a celebratory dinner. That's the point I'm making.
Sure. No, and I understand that. I'm just wondering, because there were 80 people attending, and even before the government had changed the rules to say that you couldn't have 80, you couldn't have 50, was the rules before the government changed the rules. So we knew you couldn't have 50 at least. And I think the government had reduced it to 15. I'm wondering, did you know there were 80 people? Were you able to see 80 people? Did you know there was a second function room?
I knew there was a section function room, yes, and there was a clear partition between them, yes.
Yeah. So did it strike you that there were more than 50 people present?
At the time, I wished I had have turned back, recognising that at the time. And as I said, all I can do is apologise for that, as I'm sure others have done as well. And I said that at the time. And I have no difficulty in saying it to you again today. I did say it at the time. It's not true as I didn't give an interview.
No, that's fine. And I think people will be happy and will appreciate hearing that. But I'm just wondering if you knew that the rules were 50, and most people did, and you knew there was a second function room.
I was on my holidays at the time, and like a lot of people, I would have done things differently had I thought about it at the time. I was in Clifton at the time. There was a lot of people on their holidays. And as I said, I apologise unreservedly and sincerely for attending the dinner.
Squirm. And while I have you there on the back foot...
Just on a wider issue, Brian, one of the things I think that really concerned people was to see all these different people in positions of power, a cabinet minister, Supreme Court judge, EU commissioner, the Moroccan ambassador, yourself, all socialising together like a proper golden circle. You're there in the middle of it, the chief executive of the Banking Federation. And we're told by government that they'll take a strong line with the banks on this issue that we've just been discussing, for example, the issue of payment breaks. And then we see the chief executive of the Banking Federation socialising with members of government. And I think people have to wonder, will the government take a strong line when you're socialising with members of, or the chief executive of the Banking Federation? Or do you have an inside line when you're socialising with members of government? Can you understand why that would make people feel uncomfortable or maybe even angry?
Yeah, I can if it's presented like that, but of course, that's not what happened, of course. And it's not what many people said online about that at the time. Anyone who knows me knows that I play golf. They know I'm a former member of the Oireachtas it was a social setting for people. It was a social setting where, what, I think there were five members of the Oireachtas there, no government minister.
There was a cabinet minister, Derek Cleary.
At the dinner, but not at the golf. And the point I would make
but you
is
were at the dinner.
Yeah, but I didn't speak to Dara. The idea, I was on my holiday. The idea that I was going to be lobbying for the banks or saying anything about banking policy to anyone, for anyone who knows me, that was not going to happen on my holiday. I attended that same event for probably each year in the last 15 years. And it's normally the start of my holiday. So all I can tell you is the truth, and I know others want to depict it in another way, but that's a matter for other people.
Brian Hayes as heard on Drive Time. No need for the gym when Sarah can make you sweat. Now, we heard from Bob Woodward, but it was Joe Duffy who was channeling his inner Watergate on Wednesday when he uncovered this.
A scandal has emerged in the last, 2 hours, according to our Liveline listeners. What's happened? What's happened?
So, Saturday night, steak night in our house.
Yeah.
And I use my pint of Guinness.
Yeah.
It's like an egg timer. So when the pint is finished, the steaks are usually done.
Okay.
So I had my 500 mils from last weekend.
Yeah.
When I was cooking my steak. And lo and behold, then when the steak was resting, if I'm lucky, I have a second one. Poured it, no widget, no yes. sound, no head, looked flat.
What?
Tasted what? Awful. So I assumed it was a dud. And I thought, I'll have to get another one.
Okay.
Make sure that... And second one, same thing.
No.
So...
No floating widget.
So I shook the can, thinking it was stuck to the bottom.
Yeah.
And no.
Is there something wrong with the widget?
Something wrong with the widget. And then I thought, there's something wrong with the can.
Yeah.
So I realised then that the can was smaller than the one...
But the steak is born, and the steak is born behind.
I have a smaller
the kitchen's
can,
on fire.
No widget.
The kitchen's
the
on
steaks are, the steaks are
and really... You're looking for the widget. You're on your hands and knees going around the kitchen looking for the widget. So you're saying no widget. No widget, no way. And you're saying the can is smaller.
Can is smaller and tastes awful.
And there the widget was gone.
Widgetless. Then Dave, who took it to a whole new level.
Well, I bought a slab in Dunn's and Crumlin Shopping Centre last Saturday.
Okay.
And brought them home, and I didn't realise till I opened them they were the small cans, and they poured very, very badly, like ink, with a kind of a small Ian Paisley collar, tiny collar, you know.
Yeah, the collar. Yeah, there's nothing like a
and,
small.
And, as someone says to me, it wasn't dancing in the glass at all. It was just come out black.
It was like a Vickers collar. It wasn't like the full Monty that we used
really
in the old days. Remember the old parish preachers
that's what
wear
I do indeed, yeah.
A collar that was the width of a stretched fairy liquid bottle. Remember, if you cut it open, you get a massive collar.
But I says now it must be a bad tray. I went up the super.
You were fair play to you, Dave. You were prepared to give Guinness the benefit today.
I did.
You
went super crazy.
Good man. You're a fair man.
On the Monday, I bought another tray and brought it down. But I was talking to somebody who was delivering the cans for the Agio.
You met an expert.
I did, well.
You went to the expert, the scientific expert, the fellow who delivers it. And what did he say?
And he said, no, there's no widget in it anymore. It's a fixed widget. That's why you're getting 470 instead of 500 mils. And I said, sure, I'm a mouthful short, you know.
Of course.
And he said, no, there's no widget. It's whatever it is in the can. It doesn't explode anymore. There's no little ball in it, you know.
Yeah. The mouthful short can be the difference between life and death.
Well, look, if you're getting a tray, that's 24 mouthfuls, Joe, you know.
Done out of the mouthful by Diageo. Nobody wants that. And public service broadcasting at its finest meant that Liveline contacted the drinks company, who issued a statement admitting that, yes, the floating widget was indeed gone temporarily due to COVID-19 supply issues.
We expect, this is the bad news, boys. The bad news, brace yourselves, you've suffered enough. We expect to have the floating widget back in production in early 2021. Next year.
Good luck.
Liveline on Wednesday. Now, last week we ended playback thinking that Fungi had returned. Apologies, false alarm. He hasn't, I'm afraid. And hopes are fading for his return. Fergal Keane spoke to local fisherman Sean Flannery.
There's probably one of the legends are gone again, as in Fungi. He's been here for 37 years. He was part of the town. He probably made the town. And he was part of family, everybody's family, everybody who ever got to know him. He was part of their family. And yeah, it's very sad, very sad.
I've seen him a couple of times myself. I've even gone diving with him. It was a unique experience.
Very much so, especially in the early days. He used to come very close to the people in the water, and he was very playful when he was younger. And it was an experience that you'd never forget. Never forget.
You're a boat operator yourself?
That's right, yeah. I'm 30 years bringing people in and out to sea fungi. And he was, I don't know, when you were looking at meeting somebody nearly every day for 30 years, and every day is different with him. He's going to be dearly missed.
You speak as if you have a personal, friendly relationship with him.
Very much. I mean, look, when you're going out there, and even though you're making a living from it, you're seeing him every day. he's dear, very dear.
Why was he so friendly, do you think?
I don't know. He came, he made Dingle his home, and that was it. I mean, it was just probably a freak of nature. You know, nobody can explain why he did what he did. Nobody, you know. So I know he's gone.
Oh, and it really is quite sad. But on Wednesday, Ray Darcy spoke to marine biologist with Dingle Aquarium, Kevin Flannery, and there is a small possibility that perhaps Fungi has taken a lover.
Has Fungi gone missing before, and for how long was he missing?
He went away for a day, with the best part of a day, that sort of way.
Okay.
He met up with a female companion, and she stayed with him for over a year, the best part of a year. But then she decided she didn't like the tourists, and she took off.
Right.
So maybe she's after coming back and enticing him away again.
Okay.
We don't know.
Well, she obviously knew that that's what she was getting into, you know, when she was going out with Fungi. You know, that's part of the deal. So what's the chatter locally, Kevin?
The chatter is between the pandemic and the dolphin disappearing. We're wondering what else can happen, you know.
What else indeed, because you'd rule nothing out of this year. And Gavin Jennings had a thought. He was speaking to Francis McCarthy at the Black Rock Castle Observatory about an asteroid. And you can just guess what's coming next.
You said it's not that far away, given 2020's record so far. It is far enough away, isn't it? Like, it's not going to hit us.
Probably not. It is one of the more likely to hit us ones, but it's like a 1 in 3,000 chance, and not this century.
We might get that in writing, because this year, just needs to end. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight, for my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash,
he did the monster mash.
The monster